From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, two artists working outside the mediums they're known for. Jeff Bridges is the star of such films as Seabiscuit, The Big Lebowski, The Contender, and The Last Picture Show. His new book, Pictures, collects the still photographs that he takes on the sets of his movies, documenting what's happening behind the scenes. Singer and songwriter Joe Pernice of the Pernice Brothers has just written his first novel, Meat is Murder. It's an homage to the Smiths album of the same name. The novel is part of the new series of books, 33 and a Third, in which musicians and critics write about their favorite albums. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews a 1969 Andrew Hill recording that's just been released for the first time. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. One of the wildfires in Southern California has claimed the life of at least one firefighter and left three others hospitalized. A state forestry spokeswoman says the firefighters were battling the Cedar Fire near San Diego, where hundreds of workers have converged to try to protect the historic mining town of Julian. One of the injured men is reported to be in critical condition. NPR's Scott Horsley is in Julian, where firefighters are preparing their defense.
Engines situated both at the north and south ends of the town to protect the historic center of Julian, but outside the town, the fire continues to do an awful lot of damage. There have been hundreds of homes lost, and there's still some very tough and deadly firefighting going on outside of Julian itself.
NPR's Scott Horsley. Further north in the San Bernardino area, thousands of people have evacuated from the path of fires that are being pushed up the canyons by winds off the ocean. Adolfo Guzman Lopez is at the command center for the San Bernardino fire operation.
Most of the people who live in this area, the Silverwood Lake area, Lake Arrowhead, Big Bear Lake area, have left. They left yesterday. There were reports of caravans extending out 20 to 30 miles of people leaving. Most of the people who officials wanted to evacuate have left. Of course, there are still people left, the hardcore, the people who will not leave, probably until the fire is pretty close to their homes.
Adolfo Guzman Lopez of member station KPCC. Two American soldiers were killed today in Iraq when their tank came under fire north of Baghdad. Another soldier was wounded in the attack. The Pentagon says the men were on their way to a guard post when they were shot. The International Red Cross says it will stay in Iraq, but it will be cutting its staff. The announcement comes after the recent deadly attacks in Baghdad. Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Red Cross Director of Operations Pierre Krekenbuhl says it was hard to make the decision to cut the number of foreign workers in Iraq. But given the dangers and the responsibility of the organization to protect its staff, there was no other choice.
And to make this clear and to avoid any misunderstanding, the ICRC is not withdrawing from Iraq.
Nevertheless, Krekenbuhl admits that the reduced number of expatriate workers in Iraq is likely to result in scaled-down operations. He says the Red Cross will continue to carry out its most important activities, such as visiting Iraqi prisoners of war, caring for the wounded, and providing essential relief to the Iraqi people. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 26 points to close at 9,774 in heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 4 points. It closed at 1,936. This is NPR News. The government is warning doctors about deaths and serious side effects among patients who've received a new device to keep their coronary arteries clear. NPR's Richard Knox reports.
The device is called the Cordis Cypher Stent. It's a small tube made of metal mesh to hold arteries open. What's new about this one is that it's coated with a drug that seems to reduce reclogging. The Food and Drug Administration approved the Cordis stent in April. Then the FDA began hearing about side effects. At least 290 patients developed blood clots, and more than 60 have died. Another 50 stent recipients got allergic reactions, and an unspecified number of them died. About 260,000 of the stents have been sold so far. Heart specialists say they're taking the problem seriously, but one leading researcher says it's not yet clear whether the complication rate is any higher with the new drug-coated stent than with the old bare metal variety. Richard Knox, NPR News.
Iran denied today that al-Qaeda members and other foreign fighters are slipping into Iraq across the Iranian border. Yesterday, President Bush called on Iran and Syria to tighten surveillance of their borders and prevent gunmen from crossing into Iraq to fight the U.S.-led occupation there. Iran's President Mohammad Khatami said the U.S. charges were baseless and denied that foreign fighters have passed through Iran's borders. An Iranian government spokesman also refused to share intelligence with the United States about al-Qaeda members that it is holding. Last week, Iran gave the UN Security Council a list of more than 200 alleged al-Qaeda members it says it recently extradited to their home countries. In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained a point to close at 1,048. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sundance Channel. Film starts here. Commercial-free features, world cinema, documentaries, and shorts. Listings at sundancechannel.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jeff Bridges, is famous for his work in front of the camera, starring in such films as The Last Picture Show, The Fabulous Baker Boys, The Fisher King, The Big Lebowski, and Seabiscuit. His new book, called Pictures, shows some of his work behind the camera. When he's on the set of a movie, he takes pictures behind the scenes and then makes a book of those photos, which he presents to the people he's worked with after the film has wrapped. The foreword of his new book, Pictures, is written by Peter Bogdanovich, who directed Bridges in The Last Picture Show and its sequel, Texasville. He writes that Bridges' photos convey the very essence of what making movies looks and feels like: haphazard, messy, profoundly private, and lonely. Most of the photos are of actors, directors, and crew members, but one photo in the book is of Texan Rusty Lindemann. Bridges took the picture while he was making Texasville. I asked him to tell the story behind the picture.
The wardrobe designer was fired about a week before we started shooting, and my character had no costume whatsoever. We had nothing locked in. And the first day of shooting was one of those days that are small little scenes kind of scattered throughout the entire movie. So it's really going to, in that first day, I'm going to establish all of my wardrobe. And here I am in my trailer trying to figure out on that first day what I'm going to wear. And I hear a knock, and I say, "I'm coming." And I open the door, and standing there is a Western-looking fella. He's got a, you know, cowboy hat on and kind of work clothes. And the fella says, "Hi, my name's Rusty Lindemann. I own this ranch that you're shooting on. I just wanted to let you know that if anything I can do to help you, you let me know." And I looked at him for a second, and I said, "Can I have your clothes?"
Yeah.
And he said, "Why, sure." And he proceeded to come in and take off his clothes, and because I was playing a wealthy oil man who was exactly, you know, a fella like Rusty. And he, you know, gave me his clothes. We switched clothes. I did the first shot in his clothes, and then at lunch break, I went over to his house and went through his closet, and he gave me all of his clothes. So that was like, and there's a shot of actually of Rusty in the book. And that was like an angel sent from heaven.
So did you fit into his clothes?
Perfectly. It was just bizarre. You know, and I said, "Can I have those pens in your pocket and all those papers?" And he says, "Oh, yeah, whatever I can do."
Now, there's a picture of the Coen brothers trying to figure out how to get your head stuffed in a toilet without breaking your teeth. And that was about what?
Well, that's a shot in the Big Lebowski where they, towards the beginning of the movie, where they these two hoodlums take my body and shove my head into a toilet, and we're trying to figure out how we're going to do this this scene without, you know, breaking my teeth in the porcelain. And so this is a shot of the guys trying to figure that out, how we're going to, are we going to, you know, stick my head in the toilet and reverse it, or, you know, reverse the film or something? You know, how are we going to give the you know, the illusion that this is all happening at full speed?
How did you do it?
We just did it, finally, I think. We just, you know, worked it out. A lot of those things are kind of like, choreographing a dance or something, and you work with the other actors, and you know, the illusion is that they're taking me, but in fact, I'm taking them, you know, and they're just holding on to my body, and I'm guiding my own head and responsible for my own safety. And I grab onto the toilet and put my head in.
Is one of the reasons that you take these photographs to keep the downtime interesting when you're making a movie? There's such long stretches where you're just waiting for the lights or whatever setup you need.
There's an aspect of that, of just entertaining myself. You know, some people will knit sweaters or read books, and I take these photographs, and it's wonderful getting them back, you know. From the lab, you see the proof sheets, and it's like opening up a Christmas present. It's wonderful. There's another aspect to it. I was talking with my mom the other day, and I think she was kind of inspirational to me. She has kept a journal for many, many years. I think it's going on about 70 years now, and I think that's where I kind of got hooked on this idea of, recording your life. She does it, through the written word, and I'm doing it now through my photography. And it's just personally, when I look through this book, it brings these moments rushing back to me, and it's wonderful to feel that, you know, to have spent such intense times with people that you'll be with them for 10 weeks, and then maybe you won't see them ever again, but you'll have a photograph to look at, and it brings all those memories rushing back. And also, you look at, I'm looking through the book, and there's so many returned, visits of people that, you work with often, for one reason or another. And sometimes I get the feeling it's like different incarnations. Now you're, someone else. It's funny.
Are actors and actresses usually comfortable about you taking their photos on the set when they're not made up or when they're not in costume? Is anyone ever afraid it's going to ruin their image because it's not the kind of made up celebrity face that they're putting forward?
Yeah, I usually make a. Not an announcement, but I ask. It starts with the producer, and then the director, and then the actors. Usually at the first read through of the script, if anyone minds or would like me to take photographs, if they don't want me to do it, I won't do it. And with the actors, particularly, I can, being an actor myself, I understand what their feelings are. Whenever a camera is pointed at you. It's kind of a funny feeling,
Well, especially because there's so many tabloid photographers that are trying to get people when they're off guard and make them look bad, embarrass them.
Yeah, that's right. And I say, when if you just give me a little look, I'll be very sensitive to it and not take a picture. All the photographs in the book were approved by everyone who was, picture was taken, and everyone was kind enough to lend their image to the book. But as far as making them feel uncomfortable, usually throughout the show, I'll start to get film back, and I'll show it to them, and they'll kind of get excited about having some of these memories captured, and they'll be into it.
When you're taking pictures on the set of actors in their off moments, do some of the actors who you're taking pictures of want to stay in character while other actors don't?
Yeah, a few do. A few want to stay in character. I'll find most of them don't, really. Most of them drop it and... And then when the cameras are rolling, they're well prepared, so they can kick into it. But they give your body a rest. I find to hold that intense thing can be counterproductive often, for mm-hmm. me anyway.
Mm-hmm. Have you taken photographs of actors who insist on remaining in character even when they're not in front of the camera?
Gee, I don't know. You know, it's kind of hard to separate that idea, this notion of staying in character and mm-hmm. not in character. I remember doing an interview once, and it was when I was playing a sociopath of, I don't know if you saw the movie Jagged Edge.
Right.
But he wasn't a very very nice fellow. I mean, apparently he was nice, but when you got to know the guy, you found some terrible, despicable things about him. And an interviewer asked me that question, you know, whether do you stay in character or not? You know, when you finish working, when you come home, are you in character? And I said, no, not really. And my wife happened to be in the room. And she said, oh, and she rolled her eyes and kind of cleared her throat. And I said, what are you talking about? Why are you giving me that reaction? And she says, you may not know it, but yeah, you carry a lot of that character around. And I think that goes for most actors. And I think it does go for me too, is that you, there's an unconscious preparation that you're not even aware of. You know, a lot of that character is with you all the time and you're not even aware of it. And so these photographs of people, you know, that you take, I'm not really aware if they're in character or not, or how much is them, how much is the character. It's a fuzzy line.
You know, I'm wondering, since you've documented so much of your work through these on the set photographs that you've taken, how were important occasions documented in your family when you were growing up? You know, the birthdays, the holidays, the graduations. Were there a lot of still photographs or home movies?
You know, there were home movies and still photographs. I don't think any more than you know, normal a family would have. And probably like most families, you know, they stay in the cupboard. You don't look at them too much. For some reason, I don't know why, but I'd like to. You're asking that question. It makes me want to go home and break them all out and look at them all.
If you still had the technology to play them back.
Yeah, there you go. Absolutely, get your beta stuff going.
Because your father was in the movie and television business himself, did he like really direct them?
Actually, now that you mention it, there's one really fond memory comes to mind. This is like maybe about 10 years ago. My family had a place up in Bear Valley, California, where we would all muster up there and have a, you know, a great time together. And one day we're looking for my dad. Nobody can find him, and he's locked into his bedroom, and we're all concerned, and he's saying, don't bother me. And finally, you know, about 4 hours later, he comes out, and he says, please, I want you all to assemble at the table, the dining room table, and we all gather around, and we're expecting him to read a will or something. We don't know what he's going to do. And he says, my young grandson, Dylan, has requested that we film a version of Robin Hood. And so I've taken this time and locked myself in the room, and I've written a script that we will do. And he proceeded to direct this version of Robin Hood. And we did it all very seriously, and it was so funny how seriously we all approached it. You know, my brother, myself, my wife, and all our kids were all in it. And my dad took it, you know, the most serious of all, and he got in a big fight with my wife because he had all these grandkids out in the snow in peasant wardrobe, you know.
Right.
And my wife is saying, the kids are going to freeze out there. And my dad, you know, blew up and said, oh, I'm trying to make a film, for God's sake. It was just wild. And we have it all on, and my nephew, Casey, Beau's son, was the cinema photographer on this epic, and of course the best footage is all the behind the scenes stuff, which he very smartly filmed as well.
My guest is Jeff Bridges. His new book of photographs is called Pictures. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is actor Jeff Bridges, and his new book is a collection of photographs that he's taken on the set of his movies. We started this interview talking about what it looks like on the set, behind the camera. You were on the set when you were a kid because your father, Lloyd Bridges, was making movies and making TV shows and would sometimes bring you along. What did the set look like to you from a child's point of view?
Oh, gosh. The image that I have, and I wish I had a camera back in those days, was going to visit my father on a Western. And I used to love it when he would be in Westerns, because he'd always come home and he'd have all the boots and chaps and all that kind of stuff. And I remember dressing up and all that. But in this particular day, I went to visit him on the set, and he was supposed to be on a horse with a bunch of other guys, like a posse or something like that. And of course, the horses were too unruly and would move, so they put all these actors on ladders with little reins attached to the ladders, you know. And for some reason, that image of these grown men, you know, pretending to be cowboys on these ladders just cracked me up, and they had to remove me from the set. I just couldn't keep it together.
Your father died a few years ago. Do you ever, like, accidentally run into an old movie or a TV show of his, you know, run into an old movie on TV and suddenly, you know, from out of the blue there, you're just kind of seeing him in action?
Oh, yeah. It's so great to have that happen, you know, whenever it does, especially any films that we did together, because we had such great, great times, you know. My dad was such an amazing cat, this guy. He loved making movies so much. And unlike a lot of entertainers or you know, motion picture or any kind of actors, I guess, he encouraged all his kids to go into show business. And, you know, anytime that there was a part in any of his films or, you know, his TV shows where there was a part, he always, you know, asked if we wanted to be in it. That was great news for us, because that meant us getting out of school back in those days. But his enthusiasm for the work was probably the most important thing I learned from him. And this enthusiasm was contagious. You know, whenever he walked on the set, you would just get this idea, you know, this guy loves what he's doing, and hey, we're doing it with him, and this is kind of fun. We're getting off on this thing. This is great. And everyone's level of work would raise a notch whenever he would come around. There's so many different ways to approach the work, and there's some actors who don't like to really relate to the other actors on a personal level. They like to kind of stay in character, you know, and that you can get some great work that way too. But my father's way was a little different. He kind of considered everyone a part of the family, you know.
Well, you said that's your way too in the book, that you don't relate to people in character when you're on the set. You want to really get to know them, and that you think that might help you also in the filming.
Right, because you can bring those real feelings into the work, you know. Even if you're playing, you know, maybe you really like a person off the camera, but on the, you know, when you're making the movie, you're supposed to be enemies. He's supposed to be your kind of nemesis or whatever. Well, that doesn't really matter, you know. I think, but you know, when you get to know somebody, you can you've got more ammo to work with, you know. If you want to piss him off or tease him or, you know, and then you also have the safety ground that, you know, this person knows that I really care for him, so I can afford to, you know, really tear into it, you know.
In closing, I would like you to describe the picture that's on the cover of your new book.
Ah. Yeah, that is, that's a shot from the Fabulous Baker Boys, one of my favorite movies, largely because it was a movie I did with my brother, Bo. And this is the first day of shooting, and it was in a men's room, so the shot is filled with latrines. And I'm about to when I put down my camera there, which you can see me holding while I take a picture of Bo, you can see us both in the mirror. I'm about to put that camera down and spray that black fake hair on his head.
Oh.
I don't know if you've seen that movie or not. But it was that scene that we were filming. And in this photograph, the front of the book, you can see my brother and myself in the mirror. And then if you look on the back of the book, you'll see the rest of the crew kind of going about their task, getting ready for the shot. And it's kind of a good example of the format of the camera allows you to really look around in the frame and see all the individual worlds. You know, we all sort of live in our own world in a way, and this camera really brings that out.
Jeff Bridges, thank you so much for talking with us.
Great talking with you, Terry.
Jeff Bridges, here he is with his brother, Bo, in the scene from the film The Fabulous Baker Boys, in which they play brothers who perform in a piano duo. They're in a hotel men's room getting ready for a gig.
Can't give me an ulcer, Jack.
I'm early.
45 seconds doesn't qualify as early, Jack. Jesus, who's doing your tux these days?
Moon.
Now go to China, boy, will you? You look like you just crawled out of bed.
Be the envy of all your friends with miracle hair. This is paint, Frank.
It's not paint. It's a magical sheath which simulates a dazzling head of hair.
Frank, this is paint.
Just help me put it on, okay? You're supposed to spray in a circular motion.
Jeff Bridges' new book is called Pictures. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Dow Osmond's The Stones of Summer, inspiration for the film Stone Reader, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Knopf, publisher of Our Lady of the Forest, the new novel by David Gutterson, author of Snow Falling on Cedars, from Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members, Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive, and by Rodale Incorporated, publishers of Not Fade Away, A Short Life Well Lived by Lawrence James and Peter Barton. The book tells the story of Barton's maverick life and unique response to dying young at bookstores everywhere. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a 1969 Andrew Hill recording that's just been released for the first time. And singer-songwriter Joe Pernice talks with us about his new novel, Meat is Murder, an homage to the Smiths album of the same name. It's part of a new series of short books in which musicians and critics write about their favorite records. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When you're a teenager, a record album can have a profound impact on your life. 33 and a Third is a new series of short books, each one written by a musician or critic about the album that had the biggest effect on his or her life. Some of the albums are Dusty Springfield's Dusty in Memphis, Love's Forever Changes, Pink Floyd's Piper at the Gates of Dawn, and The Smiths' Meat is Murder. The book about The Smiths' album is the only novel in the series. Its author is my guest Joe Pernice of the band The Pernice Brothers. Morrissey, who was the lead singer and songwriter of The Smiths, was known in the mid-80s as the crown prince of mope rock because of his somber themes and lyrics. This melancholy is echoed in the music Joe Pernice writes for his band, such as this song, Everyone Else is Evolving.
I hate my life. So many compromises to the edge you kill yourself to find. I hate my
That's the Pernice Brothers. I asked Joe Pernice to read a passage from his new novel, Meat is Murder, set in 1985. It's about an unhappy teenager who feels a strong emotional connection to the music of the Smiths.
We, meaning Ray and I, with the emphasis on the I, felt like we lived in the middle of nowhere, a place where a comeback radio single could make Yes or Deep Purple kings of the airwaves again. An overwhelming majority of the kids I grew up with were weaned off their mothers onto classic Sticks and Stones rock blocks. Did the small group of us who liked faggot British music feel like we were any better than them? Of course we did. Amen to that, brother. The following exchange illustrates the nearly religious and potentially violent musical loyalty of some of my peers. I said, "I think the Smiths are a much better band than Kansas." He said, "You better not say that up at the park on Friday night, or you'll get your ass kicked. What are you, a fag?" No, I was not a fag, and thankfully the park was not one of my usual haunts. Getting our hands on a new Smiths record, and issued on a major label no less, another victory, reassured us that there was a lot more out there than the hard rock our older brothers tried to score to. Sure, we were trying to score too, but we were younger, and the Smiths were new. Youth beats tradition, like rock beats scissors or paper covers rock. If suicide, AIDS, or the bomb didn't get us, we'd outlive our elders and cash in on the benefits and misfortunes of having a greater amount of history to learn from. It gave some of us a perspective that made the rock titans of yesteryear look, well, dumb. And whether it was true or not, Morrissey sang like he was as miserable, terrified, and as poorly designed as the rest of us. He captured it perfectly. We figured any teenage kid living through those Reagan years who said the Smiths were too miserable for them was either a liar, an imbecile, or so thoroughly messed up they had no idea just how miserable they were.
That's Joe Pernice reading from his new book, Meat is Murder, part of the 33 and a Third series of tributes to albums, and this one is a tribute to the Smiths' album, Meat is Murder. So, Joe Pernice, before we go any further, I want you to choose a favorite track from the Smiths' album, Meat is Murder, and tell us why you're choosing it.
I would have to say I would choose The Headmaster Ritual, which is the opening track of the record. I think it's probably the best pop song written of the 80s, and I'll stand by that.
Why? Why?
Well, the melody's great. The music is really catchy, and the message, Morrissey's message of alienation and pain is just perfectly articulated, and it's written from the perspective, I believe, of a person in a private school in Manchester, and when I heard that record, it just spoke to me perfectly.
Okay, so this is it, The Smiths from the album Meat is Murder.
Let your young girls run Manchester schools, spineless bastards all. So is the truth jealous of you, the same old joke since 1902. He does the military two-step down.
That's the Smiths from the album Meat is Murder, which was originally released in the mid-1980s. And my guest, Joe Pernice, has written a new semi-autobiographical novel that's about why this record so meant so much in his life. So from the reading that you did of your novel, it sounds like it was seen as being very uncool in some circles to like the Smiths. What was uncool about it?
I think Morrissey's style and his personality. He was a gay celibate man, and that didn't really fly too well in where I grew up. So he was definitely an outsider, and the music wasn't hard, and the guitar playing had a lot of kind of chorus effects on it, and you know, if it wasn't really heavy and driving, then it was, you know, kind of passed off as light music.
Now, you're not gay. What did you relate to about this gay celibate lead singer?
I think it was pretty much, I think...
Oh, I should mention celibacy was not your ideal either.
No, it wasn't, actually. I think just that he was such an outsider. I think just the feeling of not being able to fit in was something that could translate to a lot of different social circles, and it certainly did to mine.
Was music a large part of your identity, and do you think it was that way for the other people you knew in high school, too, that the bands you liked said something about who you were, something very important?
Definitely, because at that time, you know, you're forming your personality or you're becoming an adult, and there's really not, you really don't know who you are, and as soon as something speaks to you, like music, it was something you could hang on to, and it gave you a personality in a way.
The track that you chose to play for us,
yes.
The Headmaster Ritual, is about being in school in England. You went to a Catholic high school in the Boston area.
Correct.
What did you like or not like about your school?
Well, Catholic school for me was a bit stifling. Probably not as stifling as it was for someone going to a private school in Manchester, but there wasn't, in my school, there wasn't a lot of art. I think there was maybe one art class, and taking religion classes was a big part of it. And, you know, when you're a teenager, you know, religion's just not, is not a huge part of your life. At least it wasn't for me. I think, When I heard a song like The Headmaster Ritual, where here was someone on the other side of the world talking about this kind of miserable state they were in, it gave me at least something to relate to, and, you know, start to feel like, oh, I'm not alone out here in Massachusetts. There are people all over the world who have kind of the same, if not similar, situations.
My guest is Joe Pernice of the band The Pernice Brothers. His new novel is called Meat is Murder. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joe Pernice of the band The Pernice Brothers. His new album, Meat is Murder, is an homage to the 1985 album of the same name by the Smiths. It's part of the series of books 33 and a Third. When you got really depressed, would you want to hear depressing music? You know, like music about depression?
I think I did. I think I've always been attracted to stuff that is a little darker. And I've given that a good amount of thought as to why, say, the Smiths, who, you know, tend to be pretty dark, why they are so appealing. And the music is what I turn to, finally. The answer's in the music. The melodies are beautiful. The playing is beautiful. And I started to think, you know, if someone could make something that beautiful, even though the music itself was a vehicle for lyrics that might be kind of, I wouldn't say hopeless, but dark, I think a person who is able to make something that beautiful is not really ready to throw in the towel, you know?
Choose another track from the Smiths album that is beautiful in the way that you've just been describing.
I would probably say That Joke Isn't Funny Anymore.
Okay. So this is from the Smiths' Meat Is Murder, originally released in the mid-'80s.
Park the car at the side of the road. You should know time's tide will smother you. And I will too. When you laugh about people, who feel so very lonely, their only desire is to die. But I'm afraid it doesn't make me smile. I wish I could laugh. But that joke isn't funny anymore. It's too close to home and it's too near the bone. It's too close to home and it's too near the bone. More than you ever know.
That's the Smiths from the mid-1980s album Meat Is Murder. And my guest, Joe Pernice, wrote a new semi-autobiographical novel about that record. It's part of a new series of books called 33 and a Third, in which people write about their favorite record. And Joe Pernice is a singer and songwriter, musician himself, and his band is called the Pernice Brothers. Well, let's get back to talking about your novel, Meat Is Murder. One of the things that this album was to you was a bridge to a girl that you had a crush on, and this was her favorite album. Whose favorite was it first, yours or hers?
I would say it was probably hers.
And so when you heard the album, how much of what you were hearing was your feelings for her?
Oh, probably a lot. And again, a lot of this is fabricated in the book. It's not exactly me, but I'll pretend it's me for a minute and say, I think a lot is attached to the music. You know, it's all about the timing. A great album appears at a time when someone is very impressionable, when there are potentially significant things going on, like a real serious love interest, and people cannot help but attach the things together. They've done it, you know. Music is one of those things where, you know, people can remember, oh, I heard that song when I did this, or the first time we danced was to this song. And, you know, it might not even be a particularly great song, but it takes on kind of epic greatness.
Yeah, and you're right, in your novel, the trick was to somehow convert our love of the album into love for each other. That's well put. So is it this way in real life for you, that you had a crush on a girl who also loved the record?
Oh, many.
Now, we've established that one of the reasons why you really loved the Smiths when you were a teenager is that they sang about depression, they sang about alienation. They wrote, you know, melodies that you loved. You liked their musicianship a lot.
Yeah.
But you really did respond to that sense of depression and alienation in their music. Now that you're a songwriter yourself, do you feel like you write songs, too, that are about alienation and depression?
I think I do. I do enjoy exploring that side of myself. I don't know why, but I actually do enjoy it. I have a tendency to look at the possibilities, the darker possibilities in situations, you know, and why that is, I'm not exactly sure. But the act of writing songs, and they tend to be dark, delights me to no end.
Now, you went to graduate school with the expectation, I understand, of teaching English. Why did you change your mind about that and become a full-time musician and songwriter?
I was playing music while I was in graduate school just for fun and with a little combo and a small record label, an independent record label in the early 90s, you know, said, do you guys want to make a record? And we said, sure, why not, thinking nothing of it. And maybe they pressed 2,000 or 3,000 copies of our record. And before I knew it, there were, you know, record labels all over, coming from every angle trying to sign us. And I, at the same time, I started to really enjoy the process of songwriting. Up until that point, it was like a fanciful type of thing. But I actually got into the craft and the method. I enjoyed writing songs. I started to really take a lot of pleasure from it. And the two things coincided, the offer of a record contract and my real kind of burgeoning love for songwriting. So at that point, I just made a decision. I'll take a detour for a year, maybe two, I don't know, and see where it goes. And I've kind of never looked back.
Morrissey lives in Los Angeles now. Have you ever met him? Do you know what he's up to?
I have no idea. I've heard, you know, he's one of those characters where there's so much gossip about him. I tend not to get wrapped up in that. It doesn't really interest me that much. I've never met him. I think I would probably be very nervous around the man. I was talking to someone, and I said, do you think he'll read my book? And they said, oh, yeah, he reads all those books. He hates them. He'll hate your book, too. So I guess I'll be in good company.
Well, I'd like to close with a record from the Pernice Brothers. Why don't we hear something from the latest Pernice Brothers CD, which is Yours, Mine, and Ours. Should we hear the opening track, Weakest Shade of Blue?
Sure, sounds good to me.
Do you want to say anything about it?
Actually, I think it is. My wife has said it's probably one of the more hopeful tunes I've ever written, which I think is kind of nice. But other than that, I'll just let it speak for itself.
Joe Pernice, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Won't you come away with me and begin something we can understand? I'm lonely as the Irish Sea and as willing as the sand. Could it
That's The Weakest Shade of Blue featuring the Pernice Brothers. Joe Pernice's new novel, Meat is Murder, is part of the new series of books, 33 and a Third. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD of a 1969 Andrew Hill recording that's just been released for the first time. This is Fresh Air. Andrew Hill recorded a few classic albums for Blue Note in the early 60s, but some sessions he recorded for the label a few years later were never released. By Hill's estimation, some of them weren't so hot. But 2 years ago, he asked to hear one of those unissued records, a 1969 date for a 9-piece band. Hill and the label reconsidered. Now it's a CD. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has more.
Andrew Hill's Nonette from 1969, with Dizzy Reese and Woody Shaw on trumpets, and drummer Lenny White on Plantation Bag. That title suggests Hill had misgivings about its old-style funk beat. It's okay, actually, but that uncharacteristic nod toward pop music may be one reason Hill didn't mind this session sitting on the shelf so long. There is some raggedy ensemble work, but also a lot to like about this 9-piece band, starting with a lopsided front line of 5 brass versus Joe Farrell on reeds. He plays saxes, bass clarinet, English horn, and alto flute. Noontide, from Andrew Hill's Passing Ships, finally out on Blue Note and worth the wait. Hill, the composer, uses his extras very well. With all the horns milling around in the background there, Julian Priester can sneak up on his trombone solo. That misdirection is typical of Hill. His pieces can sound normal enough on the surface, but look a bit odder on close inspection. Even a straight swinging line can sound a bit distracted. His tune Sideways recalls Sun Ra's Little Big Band as it sounded in Chicago in the 50s when Hill was coming up and Julian Priester was in the group. Check out Howard Johnson's tuba here. Joe Farrell on tenor sax. In Andrew Hill's Nonette, players solo one after the other in typical jazz fashion. But he used the extra horns to complicate matters, writing them parts and fragments of parts that overlay the main action. Their running comments may blur the line between one improvisation and the next, and they keep a soloist company and stimulated. Andrew Hill on piano. He got interested in rehearing this 1969 session around the time he was prepping a 16-piece big band heard on last year's CD, A Beautiful Day. Personally, I prefer this 9-piece group to that one. Its scale suits the composer better. The Nonette is lighter in tone and lighter on its feet. Thank you.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Sun-Times, The Absolute Sound, and Downbeat. He reviewed Passing Ships on Blue Note, recorded by Andrew Hill in 1969. It's just been released for the first time. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Broken Music, a memoir by Sting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, artist Maurice Sendak. He's best known for his books Where the Wild Things Are and In the Night Kitchen. His new book is an adaptation of a children's opera that was performed in a Nazi death camp. Also, Patricia Clarkson, star of the new films Pieces of April and The Station Agent. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.